Welcome back.
Hey guys, welcome back.
This is Bev.
And this is Diz.
And this is...
Trigger Warning.
And I'm going to tell a little tale today of a true crime, but this one is different.
Oh?
Because I... don't know how I feel about it. I haven't decided if I know if this person's guilty or not.
Interesting.
Yeah, usually by the time I'm done with the research, I kind of think, okay, yeah, he's guilty or no.
Yeah, you're pretty. You at least have your opinion. Yeah, pretty set.
I'm kind of leaning one way or the other, but this time I really just don't know.
Whoa.
Yeah. So
there's not many of those out there, I don't think.
Yeah, it's kind of funky. I don't know. Anyway,
I'm excited about hearing that.
Yeah. So I'm gonna tell the trigger warnings on this.
Okay.
So, there is a brief mention of arson, a brief mention of a missing person. This is murder of parents. There's a kind of brief discussion of mental health condition, including schizophrenia. And this is a case involving gun violence.
Oh, wow. A little bit of everything in there.
Yeah. And so before I get into the story, I will say our email, because I guess it's important to do that
I think it's
during
important.
Each one.
Yeah.
So our email is triggerwarning411@gmail.com.
Very good.
So you can holla at us if you want to. And we have Facebook, and that's TW Podcast, hosted by Bev and Diz. And then I'd forgotten about it for a while, but we also have an Instagram.
The Instagram.
Which is triggerwarning411, I think.
So look us up and let us know if that's what it is.
Yeah, if that's what it is, say hi, and maybe I'll remember to look at it.
We'll both try to remember to look at it.
Yeah, we'll both try. So, yeah, say hi to us if you want. So, are you ready, Diz?
I am so ready for this.
Okay.
Let's do it.
So, Antonio Armstrong was born October 15th, 1973. In Houston, Texas, to parents Don and Kay Armstrong. Kay was only 15 when he was born, and he didn't really know his dad well. According to his mom, he grew up in Cashmere Garden, which is an area that was consisted of both the working class and welfare recipients. Kay says Cashmere had some areas where drugs were pretty rampant, but Antonio and his four siblings were raised in the church, and their family was pretty tight-knit. When Antonio graduated from high school, he went to Texas A&M University on a full scholarship for football.
Fantastic.
Antonio was a linebacker for A&M and then played for them from 1991 to 1994. He was named player of the game in the Cotton Bowl against Notre Dame in 1994. And with his impressive stats, there was no doubt he was going to be picked for the NFL draft.
Wow.
He was drafted to the San Francisco 49ers and then went to the Miami Dolphins after that. And then after those, he actually joined the Canadian Football League.
What a career.
Yeah. Dawn Whiteley was born February 17th, 1974 in Atchison, Kansas, to Keith and Ramona Whiteley. Her dad said she was one of a kind and a charmer. He said once people met her, they couldn't help but like her. And one day, Dawn attended church where Antonio's mother, Kay, was the pastor. When Dawn and Antonio met at his mother's church, Dawn already had a young son, Josh, from a previous relationship. But Antonio took him under his wing and immediately treated Josh like his own. When the two got married, he even adopted Josh officially.
Aww.
Josh didn't find out until he was 16 that Antonio wasn't his biological father.
Oh, wow.
Dawn and Antonio had two kids together as well. Antonio Armstrong Jr., who goes by AJ. He was born while his parents and his big brother Josh were still living in Canada. And their youngest child, Kayra Armstrong, came along after they'd moved back to Houston.
Wow, okay.
Once they'd returned back to the States and back to Houston, where Antonio had grown up, they got a nice home in Bel Air. Not the Bel Air that the Fresh Prince was in. It was like day and night between Bel Air and Cashmere Gardens, where Antonio's family
what
had grown up.
What a fancy name, Cashmere Gardens, though.
I know it does sound fancy, doesn't it? His family was really proud of his accomplishments. He was proud that he was able to provide for his family. He and Dawn got settled with their three kids and opened first-class gym. And eventually they would own three gyms. Antonio also served as an associate pastor at Spirit of Life, his mom's church, and worked as a motivational speaker.
Wow.
And I have no doubt he would have been a great motivational speaker. Between his successful football career, his amazing family, and what seems like a great sense of humor, he was likely a wonderful role model for many. In my research, I actually found a post on the tribute page for he and Dawn's obituary that had a short but funny little anecdote from one of their friends. I love to look at the tribute pages because they have people always put personalized notes and stuff on there. And it really tells you about the people. Mm-hmm. So this one friend posted that he told her one morning, y'all have to meet my wife because she doesn't understand why I'm meeting two young women at 5 a.m. So, and the meeting must have gone well because according to the post, that they were friends for 17 years. And Antonio and Dawn became godparents for her child when he was born.
Oh, my God.
A role which they both took very seriously and cherished.
That's so wholesome.
Yeah. So I wanted to share that because it just says a lot about who the Antonio and Dawn were. And they were both very beautiful people on the outside. And it seems like they were just as lovely on the inside. The pictures of them, they were just a gorgeous couple and just lovely.
Happy
and,
yeah.
They are often referred to as the Great American Family. Two people who grew up, worked hard, leaned on family and faith, had beautiful children, and they were living the American dream.
Wow.
Unfortunately, this podcast isn't called Let's Talk About This Great Family That Had Nothing Bad Ever Happened To. So
that is true.
So here we go. So July 29th, 2016, at 1:40 a.m., a call comes in to 911 in Houston, Texas. Do you need medical, police, or fire? AJ, their 16-year-old, is whispering when he answers, I heard gunshots from my parents' room, so I don't really know. AJ stays on the phone with dispatch, answering their questions, concerned about his sister, Kayra, who is asleep in her bedroom on the second floor. At this time, she's only 12 years old. And he says to himself, oh my God, how'd you get into our house? The dispatcher tells him that the police are there, and he asks if he can go let them in and asks if he can get his sister. He's heard waking her up, urging her, come on, Kayra, come on, Kayra. And then once he disarms the alarm system, he tells the officers, I'm the one that called, I'm AJ. You can hear this recorded. Their half-brother, Josh, shows up at the house. His apartment's like a few blocks down the street. Josh's girlfriend at the time, Hannah Pylon, I think, was staying at his apartment that night and remembers him waking her up in a panic. He explained that AJ called and his parents had been shot, and then he ran out of the apartment. Hannah was in shock immediately, called 911 as well, explaining what information he basically told her kind of quickly. Antonio's mother, so Antonio is the dad. I'm going to call him Antonio, and AJ is Junior, but he goes by AJ.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
So Kay Winston is Antonio's mother, was woken up by Antonio's sister, Olivia, calling after AJ had called her to let her know what was going on. So Kay is Antonio's mother. She was the pastor of the church where Antonio and Dawn met. Back at the Armstrong house, police quickly cleared the house, made sure there were no intruders inside. When police and medical personnel rushed in, it was obvious that Dawn was already dead. She'd been shot twice in the head. Antonio had been shot once in the head. He was still alive, but in critical condition. Mm. Both of them had been shot and then had pillows placed over their heads. Investigator Lieutenant Jimmy Dodson said that this was odd, and he had no idea why someone would put a pillow over their faces after the fact. Outside, the police separated Kayra and AJ.
Mm-hmm.
12-year-old Kayra had been roused from sleep by her rather insistent brother. She hadn't asked any questions. She just kind of sleepily got up and just followed him out.
Because big brother's telling her to...
Right. She just kind of gets up and follows him outside.
Right.
Now she's standing outside in the middle of the night, surrounded by flashing lights and police cars, and she has no idea what's going on. She said that she remembered asking a passing police officer what happened, and he said that her mom had passed away and her dad was fighting for his life and he might not make it.
Wow.
And then someone brought brown paper bags and taped them over her hands, and she told them told her not to take them off. This was done to preserve evidence so they could test for gunshot residue.
That's so sad. But I mean, I understand, but like, yeah. Tell her what's going on.
Yeah. She's 12.
It's the middle of the freaking night.
Yeah. She said she remembers that she couldn't wipe her face because of the bags, so she just sat there crying and alone. Her grandmother, Kay, said that she wanted to go to her, knowing that she was basically being traumatized, but there was nothing she could do. Meanwhile, AJ was also alone. His hands were also bagged, and he was sitting in the back of a police car. Investigators said that bagging their hands didn't necessarily mean that they believed the kids were involved. They said they didn't know what had happened, so they were basically just covering their bases.
I mean, I do get that, but yeah. That's just...
Yeah, it's just...
It just seems so harsh.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, they're 12 and 16. They're children. Yeah. With the victims being a couple, the reporters at the scene, and likely some of the investigators, initially believed that this could be a murder or suicide. Mm-hmm. Or attempted suicide, technically, since Antonio was still alive at that point. Once the house was secure and Antonio was taken to the hospital, investigators began collecting evidence. The kitchen appeared to be ransacked with drawers pulled open, and one was actually sitting out on the counter. A note had been written using a notepad and a pen that were in the drawer. Scrawled on the note was the message, "I've been watching for a long time." And on the upper right side, it said, come get me. Next to the note was the gun used to shoot the victims. So the gun being on a different floor of the house meant that this was definitely not a murder-suicide.
Right.
Because Antonio's gunshot wound was too severe for him to have taken the gun down to the kitchen and then gone back upstairs.
Yeah.
Like, shot Dawn, taken the gun downstairs, shot himself, gone back upstairs.
And then upstairs.
But the investigators said it also looked like the kitchen and everything had been staged to look like someone had been stalking the couple and then broken in and tried to kill them. So they checked the house and determined that every door and window were closed and locked. No blinds were disturbed. There were no signs of forced entry.
Wow.
AJ had disabled the security system to let the police officers in, so obviously it had been armed during the crime. Since that was the case, investigators suspected the crime had to be committed by someone who was inside the house already.
Oh, that's terrifying.
So, AJ was immediately their number one suspect.
I get that, unfortunately.
Kara said from her vantage point, she could see her 16-year-old brother being handcuffed, put in the squad car, and driven away. For AJ, it was the first time he'd ever been handcuffed, and his arrest elicited a mix of, quote, shock and fear, is what he told 2020. His grandmother, Kay, immediately went to the hospital to check on Antonio, her son. She said it did not even cross her mind that they had taken AJ to the station and that she should get an attorney for him. She said she just wasn't, it didn't even cross her mind. One of Antonio's friends, who also happened to be the family attorney, Chris Collins, heard about the shooting and went to the hospital to see Antonio. He told 2020 that the waiting room was packed with people when he got there checking on Antonio. And when he went in to see his friend, he was on a ventilator. And he said, "I told my friend goodbye." He said it was clear he was not going to make it. And he said he told him to fight. But he said, we all knew what the situation was. They all knew that he wasn't going to pull through.
Right.
At the police station, AJ has read the magistrate rights, which is basically the Miranda warning,
mm-hmm.
by a judge because he's 16 and there's no guardian or attorney with him. The judge has him repeat it back to her and then asks him what it means. And he understands that he doesn't have to speak with the police if he doesn't want to. So he says, you know, he basically repeats it back. She says, "Do you understand what this means?" And he explains in his own words what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Collins, the family attorney, is at the hospital when he overhears that AJ's been arrested and taken downtown. So he wants to help him, but he knows he's going to need help himself because he's a family attorney. He handles, like, their business dealings and stuff.
Right.
He's not a criminal attorney.
Right.
Kind of like in the case with the divorce attorney that turned into... Yeah, okay. So...
We know how that turned out.
So he calls defense attorney Rick DeToto, and they end up being his legal counsel for the fight ahead.
Oh, dear.
Meanwhile, back at the police station... AJ had waived his right to legal counsel. And when his grandmother Kay asked him later why he'd done so, he replied, "Nanny, why do I need legal counsel? I just wanted to tell them what they need to know so they can find out who did this." So in the interrogation tape, the investigators ask him how his relationship with his parents is. He said, "It was a pretty good relationship." And they say, "Okay, do you get along with your mom?" And he says, and this is a direct quote, so it's a lot of likes, and it's a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
So he says, "Me and my mom, my brother and my sister, like, had our little issues with my mom, but it was never anything, like, serious. Like, it was, like, family stuff." So he's saying, yeah, we had some issues with her, but it wasn't anything.
Things.
Yeah, it was just family stuff.
Okay.
So Lieutenant Jimmy Dodson had told 2020 that this is one of the more telling things that AJ said because, quote, "He immediately kind of villainized her, which was more telling to us because we thought she was shot first. Then they asked, 'What about Dad?' And AJ responded, 'Dad was like the go-to.'" And they continued, "And any recent problems, any issues between you or him or anything like that?" And AJ told them, no, my dad's a pretty, like, chill guy." So my two cents on this little conversation, whether AJ is guilty or not, this is just about this conversation.
Yes.
Obviously, I'm not a child psychologist, but I was an angsty teenager once. And I think that this cop blew this conversation way out of proportion.
I completely agree with that.
Villainized is a very strong word here.
That was not what he was doing.
It's not unusual for the mom to end up being the disciplinarian in the household.
Mm-hmm.
Having to keep up with the grades and the chores and all that stuff. And then the dad comes home and he gets to be the fun parent.
Mm-hmm.
So even if that isn't the case, he said it was little issues that they had and nothing serious. And that's basically like a verbal eye roll to me.
Yeah, that's
so
not
villainized,
the same as villainizing at all.
So to me, it's like villainized means she took the townspeople to the beast's castle with torches to hunt him down. Or she made a coat out of puppy fur. Not that she was hounding him about his grades or threatening to ground him over a curfew.
I think I agree with you.
Okay, it just sounded like, I was like, villainized? Like,
and if he had counsel...
Yeah.
That would not have happened.
Yeah. I was just like, what are you
or
talking about?
Or at least his grandmother there, somebody.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean villainized? He just said,
one of the more telling things. No,
yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
He's just being a normal teenager, and that's a normal family is what it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, exactly.
My daughter could say the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly the same thing.
Anyway, so after this, they decide to ask AJ about the events of the day. They wanted to find out about the family's movements that day to establish a timeline and determine if there were any bad situations with anyone while they were out in public that might have led to a motive for someone to kill them.
Okay.
So, according to AJ, Dawn had come home around 5 p.m., and then his mom and dad got dressed and went to his dad's friend's event, returning around 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess it was like a dressy something. Probably, his dad probably, because he owned businesses, probably
right.
knew other business owners. According to AJ, he left at, when they got her home around 8, he then left to pick up his sister at their grandma's house. And Kara said she remembered him, when he picked her up, he seemed happy, like always, just in a good mood. AJ said they got home around 9 or 10 p.m., and that seems like a long range, 9 or 10, but he's 16. He probably wasn't paying any attention to the time.
Yeah.
So according to Kara, they locked the doors when they got home, she set the alarm, and then she went to the bed. Her bedroom was on the second floor. AJ said his parents were in their bedroom on the second floor. He had to pass by his parents' room on his way to the third floor loft, which is where his bedroom was.
Okay.
So he watched Netflix for a while, and then around 1 or 2, he said he was about to go to bed and went to the bathroom when he heard a door open. And he said he hadn't been feeling well that day, which is why he'd been hanging at home pretty much all day. So when he heard the door open, he thought it was his parents. And he decided he was going to head downstairs and ask for medicine. So he was halfway down the stairs when he heard the gunshots, is what he was telling the police. So when they asked how many gunshots they were, he said 2, maybe 3, he's not sure. He said he feels guilty because he saw the guy and should have done something. Quote, should have done something. And this statement is huge for the investigators because he hadn't mentioned on the 911 call that he'd seen the intruder. So they ask him, did you physically see a person? And he said, yeah, like, I saw him running. Like, I saw him running.
Okay.
They ask what he looked like. His response was, quote, I mean, they had a, it was like a mask and like you can only see his eyes and the mouth, but he looked like a black guy. I'd say like 6 feet, maybe. The 911 call he'd made was 16 minutes long, but he never mentioned seeing a masked intruder in the house.
I was a little bit curious.
The defense attorney shrugged that off, saying he was 16, and there's no way to know what a 16-year-old would say after hearing gunshots coming from their parents' room. Plus, in the call, he did say, quote, oh my God, how'd you get into our house? But the investigators...
So he said that out loud?
He said that out loud on the call. Oh my God, how'd you get into our house?
Like he was thinking to himself how to get in?
Yeah. Because they have an alarm system and stuff.
Right.
But the investigators don't believe that there was an intruder because they haven't found any evidence of one.
Okay.
They know that the gun that killed AJ's parents was the one that belonged to Antonio. So they decide to ask AJ about it. AJ knows about the gun, but says that he hasn't used it since he went to the gun range with his dad when he was around 8 years old. But his story changes when investigators tell him they found a bullet hole in the floor of his bedroom. The bullet had gone through the floor and straight through the second floor study right outside his parents' bedroom and lodged in the floor of the second floor. So through his bedroom on the first floor and through the study and lodged into, I think it was like either into the study floor or into the hallway floor.
Wow.
I
thought he was on the third floor.
He was in the third floor, but it went through his floor and into the second floor.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
So, confronted with that, AJ explains that 2 or 3 weeks before, he'd asked his friends if he'd ever heard a gun being fired, and when his friends said no, he got the gun and fired it.
Mm.
But he never gave them the name of the friend, and explained that the friend left before the gun was fired, which didn't make any sense because the whole point of firing the gun was so that his friend could see it or hear it or whatever.
That's
so,
weird.
Yeah. So no matter what his story was, the fact that he'd lied about when he'd last touched the gun was suspicious on its own.
Yeah.
His defense attorney says he's dumb for playing with a gun, but that doesn't make him a bad guy. So Lieutenant Dodson said that he believed that AJ was trying to be smarter than other people, but wasn't mature enough to pull it off.
Oh my.
So while AJ is still being questioned, the police have found more evidence at the house. There's a burn mark on the carpet at the top of the stairs on the second floor where Antonio and Dawn's bedroom is.
Hmm.
AJ has an explanation for this, too. He was playing with matches, and he dropped one without realizing it and walked away, and the carpet ignited. His dad came and confronted him about it and was like, and he said he was like, I don't know. He tells investigators that he lied to his dad at first, and his dad got upset. But, he says, whenever he and his dad have problems, they sit down and talk about it, and they solve it. But investigators have already noticed that the burn mark smells like some kind of accelerant. They actually find out later that the incident took place only 2 days before the murders. AJ had put gasoline in a bottle of rubbing alcohol and set the fire on purpose. And Antonio had put the fire out before it could spread.
Well, that's suspicious.
Yeah, so Dawn had actually sent Josh a picture of the burn spot through a text message. Investigators had also started talking to other family members and had found out that AJ had recently gotten in trouble with his dad over drugs. And when they asked AJ about that, he shrugged it off and said that was a long time ago, maybe 3 or maybe 6 months ago. A long time ago.
Guess when you're 16.
Yeah. Josh's girlfriend, Hannah, said that AJ and Josh would smoke weed together whenever he would come over to visit. She told 2020 that she remembered Dawn calling a few times about AJ, upset about his grades slipping, and telling Hannah that all AJ wanted to do was party now, and Dawn would ask her to talk to AJ and try to steer him on the right path. So, investigators are hoping to get AJ to confess. He's their prime suspect, but he doesn't realize it yet. But AJ continues to maintain his innocence throughout the interview. They tell him that they bagged his hands to check for gunshot residue, and it will tell them if he shot the gun. And AJ tells them they won't find gunshot residue on his hands. They won't find his fingerprints anywhere they shouldn't be. He swears he has nothing to do with the shooting. They tell him there are a couple things about the 911 call that they're questioning. First, they say that he is surprisingly calm.
Mm-hmm.
AJ said that's because when he called, he wasn't sure what had happened yet. He said, but when he came out of the house, he was bawling, and then when Josh arrived, he helped calm him down. But he was also whispering, so I think I could kind of see why he sounded calm, because he was whispering.
Because he was quiet.
Yeah.
In case there was somebody in the house. Exactly. Or whatever.
Second, they wonder why about 7 minutes into the call, he says, "It's all my fault." You hear him on the call saying, "It's all my fault." AJ tells him, "It's because I wish I had done something." He's saying he saw the intruder and he wished he had done something. Investigators don't buy that. They think it was a slip-up and an accidental confession. Of course, AJ's saying, "No, it's just because I saw the intruder and I thought, you know, it's all my fault. I should have done something when I saw him. That wouldn't have saved their lives. I don't know." But anyway. So, Antonio Armstrong died later that day in the hospital. And then later that day, AJ is booked as a juvenile on charges of capital murder.
Yeah, God.
AJ's girlfriend, Kate Ober, told 2020 it was really hard to see him mourning his parents while fighting the legal system. She and AJ met when she was in seventh grade, and both she and her parents have been avid supporters of AJ since the beginning. Kate said that on the night of the murder, she spoke with AJ over the phone, and his parents were in the background. They were all laughing and, quote, acting goofy together. After the call, they continued to text throughout the evening like they normally would. The next morning, however, when she woke and texted AJ, she didn't get a response. She tried a few more times, but nothing. She told her mom that AJ wasn't texting back, and they both thought it was odd. But then they happened to see a report on the TV of the shooting and AJ's arrest. Kate's mom told 2020, quote, "The truth is, this is an amazing kid who no way would hurt his parents." Rick DeToto, the lawyer that the family attorney reached out to mm-hmm. about the case, went to see AJ in juvenile detention. He discovered only after he arrived that no one had told AJ that his dad passed away. So this man that AJ had never met, that was coming to meet with him about defending him for murder, was the one that ended up telling him that his dad had passed.
God, they just really mucked this up.
Yeah. Antonio and Dawn's funerals, the funeral was held together on August 1st, 2016. Instead of being held at their home church, which was Antonio's mom's church, it had to be moved to a larger church due to the sheer number of mourners coming to pay their respects.
Oh, man.
AJ was allowed to attend, but he sat in the first row with a jacket thrown over his arms to hide the handcuffs that he had to wear. Afterwards, he was taken back to juvenile detention, and his grandmother Kay swore to him that she'd visit him twice a week. She told 2020 it was so hard to see him there and then have to leave him in that place when the visit was over. She kept her promise and visited him regularly, but sometimes she said he would cry during the whole visit. Juvenile detention isn't a picnic. In an interview with 2020, AJ said they didn't get to go outside. They could see daylight through a window, but there was no fresh air or anything like that. 12-year-old Kayra went back to school eventually, but said she felt like she was out of her body. But she said there's not a doubt in her mind her brother couldn't have killed their parents. AJ said that she never even asked him if he did it. He said, "She doesn't need to. She knows me." So his entire family, his girlfriend, his girlfriend's parents, none of them believe that he did it.
Right.
Investigators believe the shooter had to have knowledge of the home to commit the crime, but they didn't have evidence to link AJ. The gunshot residue tests for both AJ and Kayra were negative. There were no fingerprints on the gun, the notepad, the drawer, the pen. There was no blood spatter on AJ's clothes. But they say they don't know how long AJ waited between shooting his parents and calling 911. Then he also had 16 minutes on the phone with 911. And during those two time frames, they say he could have been dealing with the evidence. But there was no blood anywhere. No wet sinks, no showers, no soap, no hidden bloody clothes, no gloves.
Nothing.
Nothing like that. Investigators kind of decided that AJ's motive for killing his parents comes down to being, quote, a disgruntled teenager. Basically, they said his world was imploding. He was failing out of Kincaid, which was an expensive and prestigious private school that he'd been attending. Mm-hmm. Tuition was about 30 grand a year.
Oh my God.
They said that this was unacceptable to Dawn and Antonio. AJ said his grades started slipping because he was 16 and he'd gotten a car. He was focused on football and his first car and, quote, the freedom just got to me. That makes sense to me. I remember us being 16 and learning to drive and being able to get away from home for the first time, you know?
Yeah.
His parents had actually decided to pull him out of Kincaid and send him to Lamar High School, which was a public school, and that it had a more competitive football program. The district attorney and the investigators wondered if being pulled from Kincaid, where he was the star of the football team, and moved to Lamar, where he wouldn't stand out so much, contributed to his motive. They said Dawn and Antonio were coming down on him constantly, scolding him about his grades, and then eventually about smoking pot.
So being parents. Yeah. Essentially just being a parent.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
So about 2 weeks after the murders, on August 10th, 2016, something happened that the defense believed may have been related to the killings. One of the gyms was broken into. Two men threw a brick through a window and rushed in. Surveillance footage shows that they are both covered head to toe, including wearing masks. They immediately go to the front desk area and start opening drawers and looking around. They end up grabbing the computer, that's it, and then they run out. AJ's lawyers say they look like they're searching for something specific. There are expensive pieces of equipment in the gym, but nothing else is stolen. And the men are wearing masks, just as AJ described seeing the intruder wearing in the house the night of his parents' murders. The DA says the break-in doesn't affect the case because it was weeks later. Assistant DA John Jordan explained that break-ins are actually fairly common after a business owner dies because the thieves know the business isn't being run at the same standard as before.
Okay, I get that.
But the defense says the investigators have tunnel vision and won't pursue the lead because they have their minds made up. And that's basically it about the break-in. Nothing more said about it, and I think it remains unsolved. That was okay. It.
Alrighty then.
So, yeah. So, in April 2017, the case was transferred out of juvenile court to adult court, which means that AJ was able to be bonded out. He was released on bond under house arrest with an ankle monitor. AJ's trial began April 2nd, 2019. The evidence against AJ includes the following. First, the security system was on the night of the murders. AJ had to disarm it to let police officers in that morning. There are two motion detectors in the house, one on the first floor and one on the second floor. If someone had come up the stairs from the first floor, then the first floor motion detector would have been triggered, but that didn't happen. Instead, at 1:09 a.m., the motion sensor on the second floor was triggered. That motion sensor is outside Dawn and Antonio's bedroom. AJ's bedroom is the loft on the third floor, so the DA believes that the motion sensor went off at 1:09 a.m. when AJ came downstairs to kill his parents. Because nobody came up from the first floor, because that motion detector didn't go off, so AJ must have come down from his bedroom and set off the one on the second floor, is what they are saying. Then, about 31 minutes later, at 1:40 a.m., AJ called 911 to report the sound of gunshots in his parents' room. His defense team, Rick DeToto and Chris Collins, brought in an expert that testified that the alarm system was unreliable. Their expert had a video showing issues with the alarm, including the case where a door could be left slightly ajar and the alarm could still be armed. Then, if someone opened the front door, it wouldn't trigger the alarm despite the system being on and armed. Like, they left the basement. I think it was the basement door was left slightly open. They would set the alarm and it would arm, even with that door open. And then they pulled the front door open and it didn't go off.
Wow, okay.
The second piece of evidence the prosecution presents is the gunshot through AJ's floor. They explain that days before, or even the day of the murder, depending on the source, AJ fired a round through a pillow and comforter, making a hole in his floor, sent the bullet through the study and into the carpeted hallway on the second floor below. They believe he was test firing it and trying to determine how loud it was and if it would wake up his sister. The defense says AJ was goofing around. He thought the pillow and comforter would stop the bullet. And they said, yeah, it's dumb for a kid to play with a gun, but he wasn't trying to hurt anybody. The last piece of evidence from the prosecution that I'll mention is a heap of text messages between AJ and his parents in the days and weeks before the crime. The messages have a lot of standard parent-teenager stuff, you know, chastisement, deflection, frustration on both sides, but they get a little more serious later. Dawn tells AJ she's going to turn off his phone as punishment for his behavior and says, quote, enjoy your last few calls and texts. And another, she tells him, quote, you ignore every rule we set. You have shown us that you don't give a, she just put a couple dashes, about what we say, and it's time for us to deal with you. You are out of control. So disrespectful. Further messages from Dawn told him she was disappointed, that he was getting high on her dime, that he was drinking and smoking just to show off, which was, quote, pathetic. She also accused him of lying about being at basketball practice or football practice so that he'd go smoke pot or drink. A message from his father weeks before the murder stated, quote, AJ, you will understand what my wrath means. You have crossed so many lines. You don't deserve our kindness over a piece of tail. Your punishment will be severe. This is coming from me. My two cents on this. You can tell he's his mama's son, using the word wrath. If I was AJ, I'd be scared shitless. Also, using the phrase piece of tail makes me curious. Was his dad talking about his girlfriend Kate, who he'd been in a relationship with for years, or was AJ fooling around on her? Or did his dad refer her that way because he didn't like her? Or just because he was angry at AJ for shirking his responsibilities to spend time with her? I don't know, but it's weird to me. Anyway.
All good questions, yeah.
Because it's a kind of a disrespectful way to talk like about her if, like, he liked her.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if he was even talking about her. Then, the last thing he says is, quote, this is coming from me. That makes me think that what I said earlier is right, that Dawn handled a lot of the day-to-day stuff. And she probably had been texting AJ and fighting with him and grounding him and punishing him and trying to talk to him so many times about all this. And I wonder if she finally told Antonio, you need to talk to your son. You come home, you play basketball or toss around the football and everything's fine, but I'm the one that gets the phone calls about him skipping practice or failing English or whatever.
Yeah.
So I wonder if his dad finally had to step in and not be the chill guy so they could get him going on the right path.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So anyway, this is all me pondering. Yeah. I'm not assuming anything. I obviously don't know the family. I have no idea what their dynamic was. But, I mean, maybe they were equal partners and stuff. This is all just guesswork. But just kind of based on those, the wording on that, it made me wonder.
Yeah, it's curious.
Yeah. And it's kind of like just based on the people I know who have kids. Sometimes it's lopsided that way when it comes to the day-to-day kid stuff. Mm-hmm. The mom gets a lot of that stuff, and then the dad has to be the one to put his foot down.
Yeah.
The defense attorney says that DA's office went through thousands of text messages and handpicked the ones that made it seem like AJ had problems with his parents.
I mean, okay, yeah, I could probably see that.
So, me again, it's Bev's two cents again. So, I feel like some of what was being like tossed back and forth was normal teenage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teenagers with their first car skip school sometimes or skip football practice to hang out with friends or their girlfriend. They get distracted by the stuff going on in their lives and they let schoolwork take a back burner. It's probably not too uncommon for them to try drugs or alcohol. I mean, I didn't try drugs when I was in high school, but I did drink for the first time in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible night, and I didn't drink again until I was 21, but that's another podcast. Anyway, I feel like everything in the text still sounds like a teenager being a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have very well gone down a dangerous path if it kept going that way. And maybe his parents were really fed up. They were probably scared that he was going to keep going and it was going to get worse. But it seems fairly normal for a teenager to be pushing boundaries the way he was at that point.
Right. Especially at 16.
Yeah. Where that ends is him firing the gun on his floor and setting the carpet on fire.
Yeah, those are red flags.
Yeah. But I didn't see anything about texts that mentioned the gun or the carpet. Hmm. So I don't know if the gunshot, one source said that the gunshot happened the day before. If that's right, then maybe no texts had been sent about that yet. But the carpet had supposedly been a couple of days or a few days before the murder, so. And there were no texts about that from the parents. There was the mention that she had texted a picture to Josh.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me wonder if his parents had suddenly gotten very concerned, so they weren't texting him like they normally would, because that's beyond, like, we're going to ground you because you tried to set the house on fire.
Right.
It makes me wonder if they were, like, suddenly realizing his behavior was abnormal, and they were going to have to do something extreme.
Yeah.
Like, maybe a military academy or something like that.
Something, yeah.
Like, I don't know what a parent would do if they realized their child was veering off the path that far.
Yeah.
Especially with, you know, his sister in the house and stuff. That's dangerous.
That is.
Because it was on the second floor and it was near their bedroom, but his sister's bedroom's on the same floor.
Right.
So, I don't know. I was wondering, like, there wasn't anything in text messages about that. So I'm wondering if there was, like, if that was the point where they were like, something extreme's got to be done. And maybe super. There weren't text messages about it because they were going to be like, we need to sit down and talk to him because something extreme has to happen now because this has gone too far.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So the defense countered each of those pieces of evidence like I described. When it was their turn, they offered up another suspect. And this is someone who had access to the house and knew the alarm system. They had the same intimate knowledge of the house layout. They've been having some of the same issues with Antonio and Dawn recently, and they knew where Antonio kept his gun. Basically, this suspect had everything that made the police and the DA look at AJ. But this suspect also had some mental health issues, too. So they asked the jury to consider Josh as the killer.
I knew you were going to say that.
Josh lived down the street and showed up at the scene right after the police arrived. AJ's defense team had interviewed family members and knew from them that Josh had issues with his parents in the past. According to Antonio's sister Olivia, things changed for Josh when he was 16 and found out that Antonio wasn't his biological father. According to an article by KHOU11 TV in Houston, at one point Josh had dropped out of Blinn College and was smoking marijuana daily. He moved back in with his parents, and his grandmother said he was different. Quote, his hair wasn't kept up and his clothes were dirty. Kara said sometimes she would hear him in the bathroom talking to himself. Then, Josh had a party at his house, complete with booze and marijuana, while Dawn and Antonio were out of town. They kicked him out after that. But it looked like Josh was actually turning things around. He'd gotten a job at the family's gym, and he was taking college courses again. He and his mother in particular were very close, and because he was working to improve his life, Dawn helped him out. She had found him an apartment. She bought him some furniture for it. And she leaned on him for support when it came to the struggles with AJ. So Josh's girlfriend, Hannah, that I mentioned before, said she had lived with Josh and she knew him well. She told the jury that he could never have killed his parents. She also testified that Josh had never exhibited any symptoms of mental illness until a few months after his parents' death. Neither the prosecution nor the defense actually called Josh to testify in the trial. So, after 19 hours and 10 minutes of deliberation, the jury could not come to a unanimous agreement.
Wow.
8 of them believed that AJ was guilty. 4 believed that he was either innocent or they had a reasonable doubt about his guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So, a mistrial was declared. Immediately, the district attorney's office said they would prosecute him again. By the second trial in 2022, AJ had been on house arrest wearing an ankle monitor for around 2,000 days. Between the first and second trial, his girlfriend Kate delivered a baby boy, whom they named Hendrix Antonio, his middle name in honor of AJ's dad. The second trial began October 3rd, 2022.
Okay.
The two new prosecutors are brought in this time, Ryan Trask and John Jordan. John Jordan I quoted earlier because he was in the 2020 episode, but these two were actually not the ones that tried the first trial.
Yeah.
They decide not to worry about the motive for the murder. And they said, quote, you may not know why he did it, but you'll know he did it. They focused on cell phone data that they now had the technology to access. So they found that on the night of the murder, July 29th, 2016, AJ had unplugged his phone at 1:08 a.m. The only reason he would unplug his phone at that time would be because he was, quote, on the move. So the motion detector on the second floor then is triggered at 1:09 a.m. There was no other activity on AJ's phone until 1:40 a.m. when he called 911. So prosecutors say AJ unplugged his phone, then went downstairs, tripping the motion detector, and murdered his parents. He called 911 30 minutes later and didn't mention an intruder during the 16-minute call. This time, the defense doubled down on their theory that Josh committed the murder instead of AJ. So it's basically the same information again, except they knew that AJ unplugged his phone at 1:08. The only other thing they brought in this time was they were allowed to bring in Josh's medical records this time.
Oh, okay.
They weren't allowed to the first time. This time they were allowed to. Portions of the records were read by AJ's attorney, Rick DeToto. And these are some of the phrases from them. Josh is extremely psychotic, with command voices to hurt self and others. Brought to hospital by police with psychotic symptoms. Patient experienced watching the murder of both parents in 2016.
Whoa.
These records were obviously from a hospitalization after the Armstrongs' murder. The DA explains that Josh likely did believe that he witnessed their murders because he was outside when the parents were taken away that night. One to the hospital, one to the morgue. That night, Josh's hands had also been bagged and tested for gunshot residue, and the test came back negative. But a gunshot residue expert had previously testified that GSR wasn't usually found with the type of .22 caliber gun that Antonio had. So none of them would have had gunshot residue anyway. It wasn't common with that gun. They believe that the murder basically kind of was a catalyst bringing on the symptoms of schizophrenia in Josh. They said the evidence never led to Josh, and they could have called him to the stand, but, quote, we didn't believe we needed to use him to convict his brother. So, hi, it's me again. This is my two cents again. Okay, I understand defending your client. I understand implicating his brother if you really think you have legitimate evidence that he committed the crime. Mm-hmm. But gathering his medical records and trying to use them to make him seem guilty when the records are of his mental health after the fact mm-hmm. is a really shitty thing to do.
Yeah.
This poor guy lost his mom, lost the man who had essentially been his father most of his life, lost his brother to prison, and then basically lost his mind. And Hannah said a few months after the murders that he changed from a happy, loving person to one who was paranoid and obsessed with solving the murders. He even wrote a list of people who could have killed his parents, including her. She told him she was in bed in his apartment that night, so she couldn't have done it. About 5 months after the murders, he asked her to go to Colorado with him because he was convinced people were after them. The note that was left in the kitchen that said, I've been watching for a long time, was the source of his paranoia. She told the jury, quote, he was slipping away. She ended up staying with him for a year after the murders, but it got worse and worse until she had to leave. During her testimony, she made it very clear that Josh had had no symptoms of mental illness before the murder of his parents. From her description, it sounds like his family had been torn apart and it broke him.
That is so sad.
And speaking of his family, where was their support? Everyone from AJ's grandma to the frickin' garbage man insists that AJ didn't do it, but no one seems to be supporting Josh except his ex-girlfriend. So that's the true. Same people who are showing such support for AJ should be the ones showering AJ's brother with the same love and trust. Shouldn't his family have told AJ's lawyers, there's no way Josh did this, Josh loved his parents? Or were they okay with it because he's Dawn's kid and not biologically Antonio's? Was AJ okay with his defense suggesting they throw Josh under the bus? Because that's just cold. Okay, rant over.
Very good points, though.
Yeah. I was just like, why are they all, like, okay with this?
Yeah, it's like, where's the rest of the family now?
Yeah.
Where's grandma?
Yeah, they aren't all jumped up in air. I mean, every single one of them is just like, AJ didn't do this, AJ couldn't do this, AJ couldn't do this. And I'm like, what about Josh?
Did the sister ever say anything about if she thought Josh did it or anything
like that? But she said that she heard him in the bathroom talking to himself sometimes.
Oh, that's right.
And it's like,
she's 12 then.
Yeah. I'm like, so? I talk to myself sometimes when I'm by myself.
Yeah.
He could have been singing. You know, like, who knows? Like, I'm just like, so it's okay to throw him under the bus. Okay. Mm. Anyway. Mm. So, on October 26, 2022, the jury announced that they could not come to a unanimous decision. This time, there were 8 people who thought AJ was innocent or that had a reasonable doubt about his guilt. 4 people who thought he was guilty. So, mistrial number 2. So, AJ's lawyer, Rick DeToto, said in an interview that the district attorney's office must have spent millions on this case up to that point, and it was time to let AJ go. But the DA knew they wanted to try him again.
Oh my gosh.
Assistant DA John Jordan told 2020, quote, "It's almost embarrassing we weren't able to convict him, and this was not going to happen again." Mm. So, 2 cents, Bev, again. I'm not sure if AJ is guilty or not, but that statement alone does sound like it turned into something personal for them.
Yeah.
And that ego had a lot to do with it at this point.
That sounds a little ego-y.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Rick DeToto said when they heard that they were going to try AJ for a third time, he thought it was a complete bleep. And I think he meant bullshit, but it was on 2020, so I don't think they're allowed to say that.
So we'll say bullshit.
He said it was complete bullshit. That's what he said. he said that he believed it was political at that point and that they needed to get a not guilty verdict or the saga was not going to end. So, AJ's grandmother, Kay, said the family couldn't believe it. Waiting for the third trial, AJ and Kate got married. Aww. He and his girlfriend. Kay said they wanted to move on with their lives, but that wasn't going to happen. So, AJ's third trial was due to start June 2023. But the prosecution knew they needed something big to tip the scales in their favor this time. After 2 mistrials, they needed a verdict. They decided to bring in an expert blood analyst to look at the pillows that had been placed over Antonio and Dawn's faces after they were shot. The expert, Sergeant Celestina Shelley Rossi, came in the Friday before the trial was set to begin that June so she could see the evidence in person. She looked at the evidence list and saw that a shirt, a pair of pants, and a pair of sandals were listed. These were AJ's clothes that he'd worn when he was brought in for questioning the night of the murders. Sergeant Rossi asked if she could look at those first. In 2016, the lab had determined there was no blood on the clothes. In fact, the type of gun Antonio owned didn't cause blowback gun spatter. No GSR, no blowback. Sergeant Rossi laid out brown paper, then laid out the shirt for visual inspection. So when AJ had been brought in that night, he was given a sticker, a visitor sticker, mm-hmm. that was stuck to his shirt. It was still stuck there when she was looking at it, up on the upper right chest. Sergeant Rossi noticed it and did what no one else had thought to do in 7 years. She peeled it back. On the back of the label, she found small reddish-brown stains. She said she didn't get too excited because she'd been on the job long enough to know that there were a lot of things that looked like blood that weren't. Mm-hmm. So the first thing she did was a presumptive test. She swabbed it with a chemical that turns dark green when in the presence of blood. It did, indeed, turn dark green, so she knew it was presumptive positive for blood. Both of the district attorneys were in the room with her at the time and immediately contacted the court and the defense team to explain what they'd found. There was a camera in the room as well. The camera, you can't really see what she's doing because of the angle, but you can kind of see, like, there's other people in the room and stuff, so.
Okay.
Anyway. So, the trial was delayed so the new evidence could be processed. Everyone's reaction was basically, how is this just now being found after 7 years and 2 trials? So, the blood was sent for DNA, and the Houston Forensic Science Center had results on the sample very quickly. Sergeant Rossi was told that it had been identified as a single source to Antonio Armstrong Sr. The defense decided to go ahead and allow the evidence in because they already had a jury waiting and they believed it made the prosecution look desperate, like they didn't have any evidence and were trying to come up with something or anything to make their case.
Okay.
So, July 31st, 2023, the trial finally begins, the third trial. The DA explains that the gun used in the killings doesn't produce a blowback blood spatter. Sergeant Rossi takes the stand and describes the stains as expiration blood. She said as Antonio was struggling to breathe, his airways were filling with blood. This was causing tiny particles of blood to become airborne. She stated that the particles would have gotten on AJ when he was close to Antonio, such as when he was placing the pillow over his dad's face. They were then preserved when the sticker was placed over them. The defense questions why the trained officers and investigators never saw blood on AJ's shirt, face, or hands. Sergeant Rossi tells the jury this is because the surface area of the blood drops are very small, the size of the lead from a mechanical pencil. So as they're flying through the air, they're drying. This means they don't soak into the shirt. The specks on the shirt were dry, just kind of sitting on the fabric. When AJ was taken to the police station and his visor badge was stuck to him, it happened to stick to them, keeping them basically from being lost. The defense argues that the blood evidence, suddenly found 7 years later, is from cross-contamination with the other evidence in the case, likely the pillowcases.
Well, I've got a question about this.
Okay.
Okay, so could it just be that he went to check on his dad? And he's breathing and it's blowing the little particles everywhere? And it's not because he shot him or something?
It's because when he got when he was on the phone with 911, he went and got his sister and went directly downstairs. He didn't go to check on his parents. Yeah.
Okay.
So they say after all these years and two trials, the blood has flaked off evidence in one box or bag and gotten into other evidence, and that's why it was found after all this time. That's what the defense is saying. That it's cross-contamination from the other evidence, from the evidence being moved around so much, whatever. So, after 10 hours of deliberation over 2 days, the jury came back with a verdict on August 16th, 2023. AJ Armstrong was found guilty of killing his parents, Antonio and Dawn Armstrong. He was sentenced to life in prison. Because he was 16 when the crime occurred, he would be eligible for parole in 40 years. After the trial, prosecutors spoke with the jury, and they said it was just as important to them to exonerate Josh as it was to convict AJ. Courtney Fisher, a local reporter who covered the case from the night it started, said that jury members told her it wasn't the blood evidence that convinced them of AJ's guilt. It was his lies on the 911 call and in the interrogation video. My two cents on that, again... is that it's kind of hard to believe that they're saying that the only new evidence, the bloodstains found on the visitor badge, had nothing to do with the conviction, and that the evidence used in the two previous trials that resulted in mistrials is what had 12 people unanimously decide that he was guilty?
Yeah, I don't buy that at all.
I guess jury selection is really important. I don't know.
Wow.
It's like, okay, 24 people before you couldn't decide based on this evidence.
And then you bring the
Then blood. You have suddenly blood evidence that's new, and y'all could decide, but you're saying that had nothing to do with it? Right. Okay. Assistant DA John Jordan told 2020, quote, "Being a parent myself, I kind of wonder how Dawn and Antonio would feel. They probably forgave him the moment he killed them." Kay Winston, Antonio's mom, said they would not be at peace with what's happened to their son. His little sister Kayra told 2020 that she's devastated by the verdict. She said she'll always remember her mom being her best friend and her dad being the strong role model he's always been. In May 2024, Patrick McCann, AJ's new defense attorney, requested a hearing regarding what role a fired worker may have played in AJ's conviction. AJ was actually notified through the court by Harris County District Attorney's Office that his case, quote, may be associated with Rochelle Austin. Rochelle had been hired by Houston Forensic Science Center. If you'll remember, that's the people that ran the DNA test on the blood found on the visitor badge.
Uh-huh.
She had been hired by them in 2019 and was fired in March 2024. Her termination was due to, quote, an inability to produce quality work, as well as, quote, a lack of attention to detail. McCann said the information about Rochelle Austin would have been critical in the decisions made by AJ's defense team during his trial in August of 2023. He said the employee's performance issues were obviously known prior to when the DA was made aware of them and when they then informed the courts. McCann wanted to know when the information could have been disclosed and if it was deliberately withheld until after the trial. The DA's office listed two examples of Rochelle's, quote, lack of attention to detail. In April 2023, it was found that male DNA samples had been switched at some point during her testing of the samples. Then, in March of 2024, she did not follow chain of custody protocols and, quote, processed the wrong sample.
Wow, that's pretty...
Yeah,
so that's like
late. It's a big deal. Yeah. That's why they have to send out a letter to notify people that...
So, like, everything she ever
she may have
on...
touched, yeah, she may have interfered with her case somehow.
Wow.
In his motion, he stated that defense attorneys could have used information about Rochelle Austin and her work to support their theory of cross-contaminated DNA samples. He said it also would have helped in an attempt to discredit Sergeant Rossi's theory of the crime. It turns out that a month after AJ's conviction in August 2023, Patrick McCann had filed a motion for a new trial due to his questions about Sergeant Rossi's credibility.
Oh.
She had actually been the subject of a complaint in 2019 that alleged she planted fabricated DNA evidence in another murder trial. District Court Judge Kelly Johnson did not grant McCann's request for a fourth trial, however. I couldn't find anything more recent on the issue with Rochelle Austin or any upcoming appeals. AJ's family still supports him and stands by him. They're raising funds to cover his legal fees. And that is the story of the murders of Antonio and Dawn Armstrong.
What an absolute mess.
Yeah.
So, the sergeant who came in and lifted up
the badge.
The badge,
yeah.
And everything. And who they were like, there was a complaint about her. Is it, do you think it's normal for that person to give their opinion about?
I mean, she's a professional blood stain analyst or whatever. So, she's supposed to know where it came from and stuff like that, but.
It just seems weird that she would say that.
Yeah.
In trial. Unless they just point blank said, what is your opinion?
Yeah. She was saying that. Because it's so small and everything, that's where it would have come from.
But for her to say when he was put the pillow over his, like that.
She was saying he had to be close to him, so perhaps when he was putting the pillow over his face.
But like that sounds like she's like, he did it.
Yeah. Because she was saying he did it. Because it's his dad's blood, so it had to be.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But, and that's the thing, like, and that's why the guy was asking for another trial, because she'd already had a complaint that she. Somebody thought she had planted evidence. Fabricated evidence.
Keep going back and forth like you.
Yeah.
Because like...
And I'm telling you, this guy is... If you watch the 2020 on this case, the kid is... The way that he talks and he seems innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he has convinced his entire family, his girlfriend and her... parents, and sitting there talking to the reporter, and just seems like, just from him talking, it feels like he could convince you he was innocent. If he can do all that,
mm-hmm.
and he is guilty, then he is
an amazing
a psychopath.
Yeah.
Because he comes off as innocent when you just sit and listen to him talk.
That's crazy.
But then you listen to, like, some of the stuff, and it's like, yeah, it makes sense that he was in the house. That he set the carpet on fire. Like, that's the kind of, the carpet and the shooting the gun through a pillow and a comforter is the stuff that kind of makes me go, but wait. Like, I can get past all the teenager stuff, the yeah. car, smoking some pot, you know, like, skipping school. Like, that's not as big
that's
a deal to
pretty
me.
Pretty normal. I
yeah.
guess.
Yeah. I'm yeah, like, he's a kid that's used to having some money. And could kind of get away with some stuff. And, you know, his dad's kind of famous and, like, whatever. And I'm like, okay, I could see him getting away with stuff. So he kind of feels entitled, like he can get away with some things. But setting the carpet on fire or firing a gun.
I mean, that's...
That's serious.
That's next level, actually. That's
yeah.
That's actually super concerning.
Yeah.
It seems like that is on a path that you do not want someone going down.
Exactly. And
but
so that's where I start questioning. Yeah. That's where I start questioning, okay, could he have done it? And then I'm like, but, you know, like, but he seems innocent. And it does seem like they basically were like, oh, it's him. Because the way that the DA and the investigators talk about it, oh, he villainized his mom.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like they ridiculous. Also, like, just honed in on him and they were like, it's him.
Well, because he was the oldest and he was a boy.
Yeah. Well, and they could hear on the phone call that he woke his sister up from a dead sleep.
Well, and that's my thing, too. If he heard gunshots, would she not have, like, even if she didn't know what it was, wouldn't it have probably woke her up since she was on the same, level of the house.
Necessarily.
I guess.
If it was a 22, it's probably not that loud. And then the sound is so quick.
That's true.
And if she was completely asleep, he was supposedly awake and was on his way to the bathroom.
And it's not a sound that she's going to hear that often, yeah. I guess. So she.
I mean, like, oh, with her being asleep, it was probably more like a pop, pop, pop than anything, and it wasn't loud. And I saw a video or something about it once because there was a case where somebody said that they didn't hear the shots and they were in the same house.
And they, it was a big house, too.
And they were like, yeah, it's a high decibel sound, but it's such a short sound. And through walls and stuff, it was so quick that it was legit that the person couldn't have heard it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because you think that it's going to sound like explosive, but it's really not that loud.
I don't know. I just keep going back and forth.
Yeah. That was the thing. When I was researching it, I was like, when I first started the case, I knew that he'd had three trials. I knew that the third one they found him guilty. So I was like, okay, this kid killed his parents. Let's see what happened. Then I'm like, as I'm going through and like putting the research in, I'm like, oh, okay.
Did he do that?
I don't think he did this. And then I'm like, actually like typing up my notes and I'm like, I don't know. Maybe he didn't.
So you were saying that the basement door was kind of left.
And that in the guy that did that was supposed to be like the alarm expert or whatever, had like in the video that he presented or whatever for their alarm system, the basement door was open slightly.
Theirs was. Or it's just in the video
with the same type of alarm system. Okay. The basement door was open slightly and they could still set the alarm, which is not supposed to be like that. And then you could open the front door and the alarm wouldn't go off.
So in their house, the Armstrong house, no doors or windows were open?
Nothing was open. Everything was locked. No blinds were, messed up where somebody tried to come in or open something.
I mean, they said it sounds like it has to be from someone inside.
Yeah, it does. And then, unless somebody knew the alarm system code.
And Antonio did not have gunshot residue on his own hands?
No. And like I said, if he had shot Dawn twice, and then, he would have had to either lay on the bed and shoot himself. Yeah, go downstairs, lay the gun down and write the note and then come back up.
So frustrating.
Yeah.
Because just when I think, oh, this might be, I might get it. Nope.
Yeah. It's very confusing.
And then the note.
And the note, you can actually see the note on the 2020 episode. And the way that it's written is written if you're watching a movie and they're trying to make it look like somebody who has mental health issues scribbled it, where it's multiple lines making up each letter of the note, of each word. So it kind of looks like it's scratched on there, with each, there's three or four lines that make up the part of the stick of the eye, and stuff like that. And so when I first saw that, I was like, it looks like they're trying to make it look like somebody that's kind of crazy wrote the note. But then you find out later that, Josh had, schizophrenia or whatever, but it didn't really start showing itself until after the murders.
After everything happened.
Yeah. And so he may have had a few symptoms if what the little sister said was true, that she heard him talking to himself in the bathroom. It may have been very little beforehand. Maybe he had a few symptoms here and there that showed, but then after, it could have really been something that kind of snapped. And it's sad because, they said that the family said that he disappeared. He went and they don't know where he was anymore. Josh just kind of went away.
He just disappeared?
He disappeared. They don't know where he is.
That is so sad.
Yeah. It's really sad. And I couldn't find anything else about him. I think that was in 2018 or something. I don't know. Maybe after that, I don't remember. Because the second trial was 2022.
Yeah.
So it might have been after that. But yeah, they never called him to testify in any of the trials, even though the defense was trying to say he might have done it. So they were accusing him, And that's the thing. I'm like, were you even, like, did you even really think that he did it? Or were you just trying to get AJ out of it?
Yeah.
You know? And that's why I was saying it's just, it was really shitty to do that if you were just trying to get AJ out of it.
Just trying to find somebody else to pin it on.
Yeah. So I'm like, what if everybody believed you and then they went and arrested Josh?
Well, and then it's like, if Josh had done it, he's right there with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, he was actually in his apartment hanging out with his cousin. And then the girlfriend was asleep in the bedroom when he came in and told her what AJ called and told him what had happened. So he wasn't, like, hanging out by himself while she was asleep. He was with his cousin. He actually had another witness that, an alibi. He was somewhere else. He was in his apartment with his cousin, and then AJ called, and then he went and woke Hannah up and was like, my parents have been shot.
Yeah. And then left.
And left.
To go to their...
Yeah, because he lived, like, less than a mile
That's
away.
That's just... Come on now.
Yeah.
Come on.
And one source, or maybe a couple of them, said that when he left, he grabbed a shotgun. But when he got there, the police were already there. And they were like, you know, he found out his parents had been murdered. He showed up, so they didn't, you know, like, arrest him for having a gun or anything. They just were like, yeah, calm down, it's okay, you know. But they bagged his hands and stuff, like... Like they did with the other two. Yeah. Yeah. It's a sad story and I have no idea.
Well, and especially if it really was someone, not family, just an outside person, like it seems like they were very loved by so many people.
Mm-hmm.
Unless somebody was just very jealous of them or something.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah. And that break-in, I don't know that it really has anything to do with it. Because, I mean, that one attorney did make a point that, yeah, probably when a business owner dies, their place probably does get broken into and stuff. That probably does happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, could y'all not maybe look into it a little bit?
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, it happened weeks later. It's like, no, it happened like, they died on like the 29th of July and that was August 10th. It was like 2 weeks.
Yeah. Not that far.
Yeah.
It could definitely be related.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that Antonio was into anything illegal or anything, but maybe they were worried that he found something. Maybe one of his employees was into something that, you know, and they were thinking that he'd found out about it. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe, and it could be AJ. I have no idea. If you think about the house being locked up and everything, it makes sense that it was AJ.
Yeah.
Because I definitely don't think it was the 12-year-old.
I don't think it was her either.
I mean, 12-year-olds have killed their parents, but I don't think it was her.
Well, especially since you have the 911 call.
Yeah. And he did unplug his phone, and the second floor sensor did go off. If his phone unlocked at 108, and then the second floor sensor went off at 109, and he killed his parents, when did he go downstairs and write the note? Because they didn't say anything about the first floor sensor going off after that.
That's true.
That motion sensor for the first floor should have gone off sometime between 109 and 140 when he called 911, right?
I would assume so.
So, when did that go off? Because he would have had to go down to the kitchen and write the note. See, I'm telling you, this one was so confusing. Like,
going in circles.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, it's him. No, it's not. Yeah, it's him. Maybe it's him. No, it's
like,
not.
It seems like it's him. Like we're saying... There's no one else in the house, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Everything's locked up. The only sensor that shows anything is the second floor.
Yeah. But then it's like, yeah, but is the only sensor that shows anything. Yeah. Unless they just didn't say anything about the first floor sensor, but it seems like they would have.
That would be kind of important.
If it was after the second floor sensor, it would have shown even more that it was him.
Yeah.
If it was the second floor that went off first and then the first floor, then it would have been like, it had to be him coming down instead of them coming up.
And to leave a note in the gun just laying there, that's really weird.
Yeah.
Like, who would leave the gun there that's been used?
Yeah. And it was Antonio's gun, so it had to be somebody who knew where he kept it.
Yeah.
Because he hid it either under the bed or in his side table is what somebody had said. So they had to go in and get it out from under the bed while they were sleeping.
16-year-old boy could do that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know?
But like I said, how did he go down? Like, did he turn off the motion sensor somehow?
Well, that's...
Is there a panel up there? But if he could do that, then how did he not turn off the second floor one? He did not think about that, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
How did he go downstairs and write the note without triggering the first floor one? Maybe the first floor one wasn't working. But if it wasn't working, then they can't use that as evidence that he... That it wasn't somebody but coming upstairs. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to stop now. Okay, my brain hurts.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah, tell us your theories, please, because I have no idea what's going on.
What do you think may have happened? Do you think he's innocent or guilty?
Or is your brain just spinning in circles like mine is?
Yeah, that's definitely where I am.
Yeah. Because his entire... And this is like the first time, I think, that I've ever seen a case where the prosecution is sure that they've got the right person, but the victim's family, who happens to be the family of the perpetrator, all believe that the perpetrator didn't do it. Because usually you've got the victim's family being like, you know, yeah, they've got the guy, they're going to get him. I can't believe he didn't get the right amount of time or whatever. And this is like the first time I've seen where they're just like, he didn't do it. And everybody thinks that way.
And you know, in a lot of things, I feel like a lot of cases that I've seen where a teenager maybe did kill their parents,
mm-hmm.
they leave.
Yeah.
They don't hang around the house to make the call usually.
Right.
Or they'll have been gone and then you come home and like, oh my gosh, my parents.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Unless it's like he did it and he didn't want to leave his sister there to find them.
Yeah. That's possible.
Gosh, but, I don't know.
And then in between his trials, like he stays around and has a family.
Yeah, that's...
He stays with his girlfriend and has a child. He names after his dad and then marries his girlfriend and like, you know. And now she's got this child that she's raising by herself and has this pound of, like, legal bills that I'm like...
But, like, people have done crazy things like
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Like, I can also
Like I said, it. If he can make this interview, like, seem like he's innocent and also convince everybody...
Watch that interview.
Yeah. I mean, so he just seems so sincere and honest and just... And I'm just like, how? I don't get it.
I mean, unless somebody was like, I hate these people, but I'm going to frame their son.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, everybody, tell us what you think, because I'm very curious.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah.
This is one of those that'll make you think about it later on.
I told you it was going to mess with you, because I still just don't know. I was like, maybe after I tell it, it'll make it seem more, but no, it's just as confused.
You're probably even more confused.
I'm like, still don't know. So before we say goodbye in this one, we also want to just let everybody know that this is our second to last episode for the season.
What?
We've almost completed a whole season.
You guys?
Yeah, so I hope you really enjoyed this one, and we hope you really enjoy the next one, because they're the last two before before the season ends. And then season two will start in June.
Yay!
So
just June, in time for summer.
That'll be a Wednesday, June 4th, will be the first episode that comes out for season two. Yay! So we want to thank all of our fan, because there's probably one out there.
Thank you, fan.
Thanks, fan. So just so you guys know, so you're not thinking that we went away in May, because we're totally not going away. You're stuck with us now.
That's right.
But there won't be new episodes in May unless we start feeling frisky and just decide we absolutely have to record something.
Like maybe. We're not going to completely commit to that.
Yeah, not completely commit. But so anyway, that's our news.
Yay.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the flip side.
Catch you guys later. And don't forget, watch for deer.